Thanks for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. Osama bin Laden's former driver received a short sentence in the first war crimes trial at Guantanamo. President Bush has arrived in China for the opening of the Olympic ceremony after he angered Beijing with a speech on human rights. Muqtada al-Sadr says he'll dissolve his militia if the U.S. sticks to a withdrawal timetable in Iraq. And American deaths in Afghanistan reached 500. Joining me for the Friday News Roundup, Kevin Whitelaw of U.S. News and World Report, Jonathan Landay of McClatchy Newspapers, and Tom Shanker of the New York Times. Do join us, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. Good morning to all of you.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Tom Shanker, welcome.
Thank you. Very nice to be here.
You broke the story this morning in today's New York Times on how Defense Secretary Robert Gates is going to address the growing threat, even as U.S. troops are tied down in Afghanistan, U.S. deaths in Iraq, now deaths in Afghanistan have reached 500.
That's exactly right. Secretary Gates knows that because of commitments to Iraq, there just aren't the free combat brigades he would like to send to Afghanistan. He agrees they should go. His commanders have asked for them. So in the meantime, he's trying to find efficiencies in the combat operation by putting one four-star general in charge of what had been two very separate missions, the NATO stabilization mission and the American combat operation. So General McKiernan now is in charge of both of those so he can move troops around the battlefield more efficiently. Also, in another very significant decision, Gates has endorsed an Afghan proposal for expanding the Afghan National Army by 50% to almost 120,000 over the next 5 years. This will cost $15 to $20 billion, a lot of money. The U.S. will have to be the major contributor, but Gates, I know, is committed to having the allies pony up money as well.
So what is the earliest that we might see a serious injection of U.S. troops into Afghanistan?
I think given the anticipated drawdowns in Iraq of a brigade or two, perhaps even before the new president is sworn in, it'll be next spring or summer before the brigades land. Remember, Afghanistan is a very, very tough winter. The fighting season really ends in October, November, and doesn't resume until February, March. The bad guys are training, equipping, practicing, but there's not a lot of direct combat in the depths of winter.
Jonathan Landay.
Actually, that had been very much the trend in Afghanistan until about last year when, or the year before, I should say, when we began to see this real surge in the insurgency. The winter applies to the border with Pakistan in the mountains of the eastern part of Afghanistan. But the insurgency, the Taliban leadership is now based in the Pakistani province of Balochistan. And the border between Balochistan and southern Afghanistan has virtually no mountains at all. It's desert. It's flat. It's great for insurgents to be able to come across in trucks and bring weapons. And if you look at open source reporting from the U.S. Air Force in terms of the number of air combat missions they fly every day, there's virtually been no diminution in fighting in southern Afghanistan for the last 2 to 3 years.
Kevin Whitelaw.
Well, you know, I think what the broader picture here is that we have seen a broadening and a deepening of the various kinds of forces that have been banding together in Afghanistan to oppose the U.S. presence. And so it's not just a Taliban offensive, a Taliban insurgency, as people often refer to it. It really is a multifaceted, multi-headed operation that involves forces from a number of different ethnic groups, a number of different warlords, some across the border in Pakistan, others based inside Afghanistan. And this is an incredibly fluid thing. And we're actually watching, in some ways, the Taliban is not even the worst, most important enemy anymore. It's really some of these other warlords that are up in the eastern areas and again, along the long and very loosely guarded Pakistani border. And so this is why the The U.S. so badly needs to augment its fighting capability in Afghanistan, and why this move by Secretary Gates might not simply be enough to deal with it.
So finally, Tom Shenker, what about the strategy in dealing with the threat spilling over the Pakistan border? Are we going to see changes there as well?
Well, this might add some efficiencies to patrolling the border, because previously the eastern part of Afghanistan along the Pak border was an American mission, along the south was a NATO mission, and there's been some gaps and seams that insurgents could exploit. The big question has always been, will American forces or NATO forces cross the border? Thus far, all sides are respecting the sovereign Pakistani rule there, but it remains to be seen if things really deteriorate, whether some sort of deal may be made so American forces could operate there.
Jonathan.
There's been a secret understanding between the United States and Pakistan under which American forces have been able to do hot pursuit across the border. I believe it's up to about 15 kilometers. And plus, we've seen the United States staging missile and predator attacks over the border at suspected terrorist targets, which is one of the problems. Those attacks, while taking out al-Qaeda members, have also killed ordinary civilians, Pashtun civilians. And this has helped throw gasoline on the insurgency and increased recruiting for the Taliban and other groups that have been involved in fighting, not just in Afghanistan, but increasingly now in Pakistan itself.
Kevin.
Well, you know, and if we could turn to Pakistan, perhaps, I mean, I think we're watching this tribal situation here continue to get worse. Again, these various attacks have fueled anger against the U.S. presence, have created support for the various insurgencies, and this is all a situation that the Pakistani government, in its own turmoil, has simply been unable to deal
and
with.
And now an effort moving toward impeachment.
Well, that's right. And this is a whole new sort of wrinkle on top of this, which could either go decently well for the Pakistanis or horribly wrong, depending on the outcome. And this is where this new coalition government of two former opposition parties who don't always get along very well themselves are now pushing, have agreed to push for the impeachment of the unpopular president, Pervez Musharraf.
And how is he likely to respond? Is he going to perhaps call up the military? Can he? Or might he resign?
Well, that's exactly the question. Everyone is waiting to see. He's been closeted with his legal advisors to try to understand his legal options, but he also needs to be able to meet with the army here and understand what kind of support he can rely on. The army chief was installed by him, but it's really not clear whether that loyalty is going to stand the test of time here.
Kevin Whitelaw, he has a new title. He's Deputy Assistant Managing Editor for U.S. News and World Report. Congratulations
Thank
to
you.
And if you'd like to join us, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. Jonathan Landay, before arriving in Beijing, President Bush delivered a speech where he discussed human rights in Burma and China. What did he say, and what was the reaction?
Well, there's been a lot of attention paid to this speech because of what President Bush had to say about the need for China to improve religious rights, religious tolerance and freedom, and the right to speak one's mind. But one gets the opinion, or at least gets the feeling, and I did because I read the speech, that there was a bit of theater in this, in that the Chinese had to know this was coming. And if you looked at the speech, it was quintessential Bush on China. He's talking about how he wants better relations with China, better trade with China, that the United States respects the Chinese people, and yet he's under pressure here at home from conservatives to take a strong stand on human rights in China, something that he himself believes in.
But wasn't his language a bit stronger?
It comes at the very, very end of the speech. And then if you looked at the Chinese response, you get the feeling that this was kind of a stage-managed minuet in a way, in that they knew this was coming. They responded in a way that said, yes, we agree. We have reached the stage where we agree with to disagree. We are a mature relationship. We can have these honest differences of opinion. And then they criticized Bush for for interfering in their internal affairs. And so one gets the feeling that this was all expected, it was pro forma, and now we move on to the games.
Tom Chanker.
Well, it's interesting. The mix of Olympic values and political realities is something we've known for a long time, and in no way to compare modern-day China to Nazi Germany, but we've seen Olympics previously become centers of political debate, and I think the long-term impact of the protests and debate is rather insignificant.
Kevin.
Well, you know, that's right. We've really watched just a suffocating security presence on the part of the Chinese. Any attempt to stage any kind of demonstration. I mean, demonstrators were, we had to resort to writing on the walls of hotel rooms and inviting journalists in to try to get attention to their protests. So I think, you know, for the billion Chinese, most of them wouldn't even know anything's going on. Very tightly controlled still. And I think people who had hoped that this Olympic Games might sort of pry the can open a bit more on information and access. Maybe it has a little bit for the West to China, but it certainly hasn't yet for the Chinese themselves.
Would you agree with that, Jonathan Landay? No opening from the inside out?
I think it's something that's very, I would say, generally speaking, yes. But, you know, it's interesting. There are mechanisms by which Chinese internet users can circumvent the official firewalls. It's very interesting, some of the programs that you can go out and download into your own computer, which are available to Chinese internet users as well. So I think it's hard to say exactly what the impact has been. You know, there was this...
years before we know.
Very much.
Jonathan Landay of McClatchy Newspapers, Kevin Whitelaw of U.S. News & World Report, Tom Chanker of The New York Times. We'll take a short break. You can join us, 800-433-8850. And welcome back to our Friday News Roundup this week with Tom Chanker, The New York Times, Jonathan Landay of McClatchy Newspapers, and Kevin Whitelaw of U.S. News and World Report. Let's turn now to Guantanamo, where yesterday a military jury sentenced Osama bin Laden's former driver in the first American war crimes trial since the World War II era. Kevin Whitelaw, talk about the trial and the sentence that Salim Hamdan received.
Well, this was a trial where as you said, it was the first one of the people held in Guantanamo Bay, and this was a split verdict. He was acquitted of the more serious charge of conspiracy, and convicted of a lesser count, which still could have carried a life sentence. And what's perhaps the most interesting element here was that the sentence ended up only being about 5.5 years, which means that he is theoretically eligible for release in less than 5 months. The real question is going to be, will the United States release him? There's been an argument all along that as an enemy combatant, they can hold him indefinitely until the end of the so-called war on terror. And it's a little hard to imagine at this point, with all of the hoopla surrounding this, that they'd try to hold on to him. But at the same time, He's a Yemeni, and there's been a lot of concern about whether the regime in Yemen would be able to keep control of him.
I thought it was fascinating that the judge said to him, "I hope you will be back in your home soon." And Hamdan said, "Inshallah." And then the judge said back to him, "Inshallah." I thought that was really fascinating, Tom Shanker.
Well, I think it shows many of the problems with those who are urging a closing of Guantanamo. There's some hardcore terrorist types that people really don't know what to do with, but the vast bulk are people who could be repatriated to their home countries if those home countries would promise to either deal with them in a legal manner or respect their rights when we get back. And that could probably empty Guantanamo of 100 or more of the detainees, which would go a long way to diminishing the problem.
What does this verdict mean for the Bush administration, Jonathan?
Well, the prosecutors have obviously held this up as being a proof that the military commission system works. But I think there's a great question as to the amount of resources that was put into this trial, into the trial of someone who was a driver, not a key figure in al-Qaeda. The fact that this trial involved secret testimony, the admission of hearsay, I don't think that it can be pointed to as some great moment in the war on terror, as the Bush administration calls it.
Here's an email from Kathy Rhodes, who says, after all these years of war, loss of life, American taxpayer money spent in Afghanistan, is this the best they could do? Salim Hamdan, a man who just needed a job. The BBC has said prosecutors wanted a minimum sentence of 30 years, but Hamdan was given a 5.5-year term, possibly released much sooner. Will this set the tone for future trials and sentencing lengths?
I think it's interesting. One of the things that's happened this week was the dispatch to the United States of a Pakistani woman, Aida Sadiq, who was accused of trying to kill an American soldiers in Afghanistan, someone who's been wanted as allegedly someone involved in al-Qaeda. And instead of sending her to Guantanamo and declaring her an enemy combatant, she was turned over to the FBI, and she is being prosecuted criminally in New York in the American judicial system. And so, to me, that seems to indicate to me that even within within the Justice Department, there's a realization that Guantanamo just doesn't work, and in particular because of the Supreme Court decision, which said that these people have a right to habeas corpus.
Tom,
the comment from your correspondent there about the money being spent, is this the best we can do? At the risk of no small irony, I want to recall I spent a very formative time in my earlier career covering Chicago City Hall under the Democratic machine, where the city motto was, "Where's mine?" And if you look at the billions and billions of dollars spent in Iraq and Afghanistan, in Iraq today, much of the problems in pacifying the country come down to where's mine and how will the resources of that country be divided. And when you look at what America is spending, clearly there's got to be a Chicago-style pork barrel deal that could, you know, reach a political settlement there.
On that very point, U.S. government auditors this week reported some startling figures coming out of Iraq's budget. What kind of money are we talking about there, and why isn't more of it being put to use? The GAO said $79 billion projected that Iraq has a surplus of $79 billion. From 2005 till the end of 2008, Kevin.
Well, you know, this is actually something that we've known about for a while, although perhaps the magnitude still comes as a bit of a shock, in that the Iraqis have been benefiting, like any other oil-rich country, from extraordinarily high oil prices. And so they've had a lot of money coming in, even though they haven't been able to boost their production all that high. So they've got very high revenues, and they simply don't have the capacity to spend it. they just simply don't have the
I don't
skills.
Understand.
They don't have the people that can implement big capital projects. They don't have the managers. They don't have the people who can supervise and oversee and prevent waste, fraud, and abuse. Most importantly, it's an incredibly corrupt government that we're dealing with over there. And if they spent that money, they'd lose most of it. And so in some ways, they're actually better off in a really strange way not
having
spending it, because otherwise they're just going to waste it.
There's a real clash of cultures here. I know all three of us have spent time in Iraq. When you talk to senior commanders there, they're always saying the Americans bring in too much bureaucracy. The Iraqis don't have enough.
Mm. And the same problem is has been afflicting Afghanistan. Afghanistan is the recipient of promises of multi-billions of dollars from both the United States and the rest of the international community, but they suffer from the same problem, this so-called lack of capacity. And this is another term for they don't have the people who know how to run these big capital projects, to put together massive budgets, to spend this money in a way that it doesn't leak out in massive corruption schemes.
Okay, but the U.S. Congress has appropriated $48 billion, already committed $42 billion to Iraqi reconstruction. As you say, probably it's better that they haven't spent it, but at this point, the question becomes, how much domestic pressure are you going to see when the American public really gets hold of this idea that all this money is hitting their taxpayer dollars?
Well, that's exactly right. And Senator Carl Levin, the chairman of the Senate Armed Services Committee, is already making this a very important issue. He sent a letter to the White House, and he's been speaking at almost every hearing about putting some restraints on American spending until the Iraqis pay their own way. I think that sort of comment is going to resonate as we approach a presidential election.
I found what the most fascinating finding of the GAO study to be the fact that with all of this money available, the key Iraqi ministries that oversee the infrastructure have not been spending more to try and maintain a lot of the projects that American taxpayer money has gone to fund, but in fact have been reducing the amount of money that they put out every year to maintain and keep up these very huge infrastructure projects.
I guess I would point out one bit of perspective here. Most of that U.S. reconstruction money came in the first 2-3 years of the U.S. presence there. This was really before the money was flowing in and these surpluses were building up. And so a lot of this money was obligated and some of it spent back when Iraq did not have huge amounts of other resources and indeed needed the U.S. funding and the U.S. ability to administer that funding to be able to implement these things. But as John says, the problem is now you have these projects that have been created, that have been started up, that need security, that need maintenance, that need continuing upkeep. And that's where the Iraqis apparently aren't even able to do that.
It's a
very damning report.
The American public was told early on that, in fact, Iraq's own oil money was going to pay for reconstruction. There are reports today that say Iraq is asking the U.S. to withdraw all combat troops by the fall of 2010. What are the chances that the Bush administration might agree?
My understanding is that in the agreement that's now apparently reached an end stage in terms of the negotiations, you would have American forces withdrawn from major cities in Iraq back to their bases by, I believe, next summer. Then all combat forces out of Iraq by the beginning of 2011. That is my understanding as to what's going on. But of course, you know, best laid plans in Iraq go off course. So we don't know where this is going to really end up.
And of course, you've now got Muqtada al-Sadr saying he'll withdraw his militia if the U.S. sticks to this timetable.
Well, two issues there. Sadr has to do that because the Iraqi constitution now says that no one can run for public office if they're still in charge of a militia. So the extent that he wants to be a public figure and elected, he has to officially disband the militia. As far as these timetables, You know, for those who want to see politics growing and democracy growing in Iraq, it's a good sign. But at this point, I think all these timetables are more aspirational and inspirational than they are anything serious.
At the same time, you know, keep in mind, this is an administration that for 4 years has said no timetables, no timetables, no timetables. So they've had to try to invent new words, and they're going to have to keep trying to invent new words to describe what this actually is. But one way or the other, it's clearly going to have a fair amount of wiggle room and flex built into it to allow it to be extended. Probably willingly by both sides, given that the Iraqis remain completely dependent on the United States for a whole range of their military and government activities.
Oh, what about the U.S. elections, however, and how might that affect these timetables?
Well, if you notice it, the timetable there is somewhat similar to a timetable that's been put out by Democratic nominee Barack Obama. And when Obama was in Iraq, that was one of the points of agreement that was rather embarrassing for the Bush administration. Another reason that the administration is having a little trouble figuring out how to describe what this agreement actually says, and most of the accounts are actually coming from the Iraqi side.
Interesting that there's sort of this playing with semantics going on in terms of this new agreement that's being discussed. You know, after while Obama was in Iraq, you had the Iraqi National Security Advisor come out and basically give a proposal for an Iraqi position that corresponded with Obama's, you know, out by the end of 2010. I don't think that sat too well with the administration. So now you have them saying the beginning of 2011.
At 27 before the hour, you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. And Tom Shenker, the European Union has today said it's going to tighten sanctions against Iran, going beyond the UN sanctions. What's that going to mean?
Well, I think if we had had this conversation 6 months ago, a year ago, 18 months ago, we could have the same conversation. There's been this seemingly never-ending round of tightening sanctions and Iranian defiance and Iranians saying we need more information before we respond. So while every step like this is a significant one for us to note, I don't see this changing the situation politically.
And there's a little tension among these major UN powers and the EU.
Well, there are a couple of things going on. First of all, we had this announcement. I think they've made this announcement actually maybe three or four times in the last 3 weeks. I was in Geneva to cover the talks between what's called the P5 plus one, that's the permanent members of the Security Council, plus Germany and Iran, where we were told that they had all met before meeting with the Iranians, and there was an agreement that they were going to tighten sanctions if Iran didn't accept the latest proposal to get negotiations started. And, of course, the other day, they said the same thing. And then yesterday, the Russian ambassador to the UN said, we never agreed to anything like that. That's the first thing. The second thing is Germany, which is one of the three EU players in this, last week cleared a company to build a natural gas liquefaction plant, three of them, in Iran, one of its own companies. So you have this image of Germany giving one of its companies permission to build these three gas plants in Iran, and at the same time being part of this effort to try and squeeze the Iranians to get them to suspend uranium enrichment. The more mixed messages Iran sees, the more you're going to see the prevarication that Tom described.
And let's talk about fighting in the Republic of Georgia. There are reports that Russia has sent forces into the Georgian rebel conflict. What's happening there, Kevin?
Well, this regards a breakaway region called South Ossetia, and we're really seeing a complicated, long-standing separatist movement here that has been obviously bolstered at various times by the Russian government. We're watching the Georgian government over years and months tried to take steps against it, try to rein it back in. This has basically broken out into open fighting now. We have Russian troops operating inside parts of the region there, and this is unclear where this one heads, but it's not a good thing. And obviously, there's a lot of concern about how the Russians are going to react to this. But this might also be something of the Georgians' own making.
Ah, Jonathan Lande.
Well, and if you step back, there's two bigger pictures here. One, this is a region very important to the transportation of energy, oil and natural gas. Oil prices have been coming down in recent weeks. Let's see what this does to oil prices now over the next couple of days if this thing goes on. Second of all, this whole thing is caught up in the tug of war, so to speak, between the United States, NATO, and Russia, where Russia sees NATO as surrounding it, and Georgia wanting to get in very aggressively to become part of the NATO alliance, and Russia struggling to try and maintain its influence in what it calls its near abroad in its former republics. And so you have this even bigger aspect, this sort of great power rivalry that now comes into play here as well.
Tom,
and you also have significant problems because all across Russia you have these enclaves, much like the nestling dolls that you buy as a tourist, a smaller doll inside of a bigger doll. That's what we have here. This is not the only one. There's Nagorno-Karabakh between Armenia and Azerbaijan and a whole host of others. They've been called frozen conflicts for a number of years. This one has thawed. It's getting hot. There could be more.
Tom Shanker, The New York Times, Jonathan Lande of McClatchy News, and Kevin Whitelaw of U.S. News and World Report. We'll take a short break and be back for your questions and comments. Stay with us.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by Miriam Muscarolis and Grant Abramson, thanking the donors to the NPR Foundation and councils for their support of NPR programming, by the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people, online at wtgrantfoundation.org, and by AMARC Foundation, supporting procon.org, with the 2008 presidential candidates' positions on many issues at procon.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Off somewhere the music's playing.
Country music's Ricky Skaggs. On his new CD, The High Notes, he plays bluegrass renditions of his own country hits. On the next Fresh Air, we feature an interview with Skaggs. Also, when is it acceptable for a major league pitcher to throw at a batter? We talk with Zach Hampel, author of Watching Baseball Smarter. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
But like a fool, I stood and watched you go.
And we're ready to open the phones, 800-433-8850. First to Dallas, Texas. Good morning, David. Thanks for joining us.
Good morning, Diane. How are you?
Fine, thanks.
I had a question about the Hamdan case.
Sure.
My question is whether or not your guests believe that this lenient ruling towards Hamdan will add legitimacy to the military commission process, and whether or not those urging the closure of Guantanamo Bay will actually suffer from this, because when the bigger guns get tried, whether or not they're going to bring out this Hamdan ruling and say, hey, this is a fair process, this is something that has its checks and balances, don't fight it.
Tom Shanker.
I think that's a very good question, and I think those who want to portray the courts as completely legitimate will say, look, the government asked for a much harsher sentence, and here's this, court wearing military uniforms gave him a rather lenient sentence, all things considered, just 5 months beyond time served, which leaves open the possibility, at least, that he could ask for parole and leaving the country.
The one problem with this, of course, is that the system is so sort of thrown together and cobbled together that, you know, each trial is really going to look substantively different. There's going to be different judges, going to be different juries, going to be different everything. And even some of the rules will, you know, inevitably be different between different proceedings. And so it on one level, it gives at least the sense that this isn't a total kangaroo court. But I think it still is going to remain incredibly problematic as we go forward.
We don't even know if this ruling is going to stand. The fact is that he was convicted of material support to terrorism, which was not a crime at the time that he was picked up in Afghanistan. And so now you know that his lawyers are going to take this to appeals process and say, wait a minute, he was convicted of something that he was not arrested for. This cannot stand. So I'm not sure that this case will lead to any kind of sort of precedent setting in terms of where we're going to go, where the Gitmo process is going
to
go.
All right, to Jacksonville, Florida. Philip, you're on the air.
Good morning.
Morning, sir.
Now that the first trial has been held in Guantanamo, the Bush administration is obviously disappointed with the outcome. Do you feel that the Bush administration will now make an attempt to change the judge and jury with military personnel more to their liking?
Well, I'm actually not 100% sure that they're all that disappointed with the ruling, because I do think that on one level they can use this case to try to make the argument that this is indeed a fair proceeding, that this is not a kangaroo court. So I think in some ways this has probably worked out to their advantage. But by design, every trial is going to have a different judge and a different jury. So, it's not clear that this is going to change the way that process works.
All right. To Charlotte, North Carolina, and to Frank. Thanks for joining us.
Okay. Hi. Okay. I'd like to say something about Bush when he made that comment about China insulting them. Okay. If we would ever get into a conflict anytime soon with China, okay, according to what I have read, we have had 1.67 million Americans actually over in Iraq. Okay, only 40% of these people actually do the fighting, according to the Pentagon video that I read on their website. Okay, so 40% is less than 1 million people. These people are going back and forth to Iraq. Okay, now this person is, you know, to me, I mean, maybe he's not causing much problem, but we see what's going on over there in Russia and Georgia. You know, he's causing problems with China. Who is he going to send if we would get into a conflict over there to fight? It's not going to be his kids. It's not going to be Congress or the Senate kids. It's going to be the same people over and over again.
All right, sir. Thanks for calling. Kevin.
Well, I think the idea of a conflict with China is sort of unimaginable on any kind of full-scale, military deal. I don't think anyone wants that. It would destroy the world economy at the same time that it would be in just a cataclysmic military confrontation.
And on that same question, here's Jennifer from southeastern Ohio. Good morning. You're on the air.
Oh, thank you. This has been such an interesting show, and I've been wanting to ask these questions, but I have two. We owe trillions of dollars to China, and should Bush be insulting them on human rights violations when the whole world has seen what we've done in Iraq and Afghanistan and Guantanamo Bay? My second question has to do with the $42 billion that Bush wants to send to help Iraq. What happened to the $343 billion that was sent there in $100 bills last year in a cargo plane, and it disappeared? I'll take my questions off here.
Do we know anything about a $343 billion shipment? My guests this morning, Jennifer, are shaking their heads. On the first question, should we be insulting China when we owe them so much money?
Well, by we, I guess you mean the United States, and I think the United States has an obligation always to make our moral case for how this country believes, the world should be, operating, and we should also hold our own country to those very high standards. The fact that we owe them a lot of money, I think, goes to the previous questioner as well. You know, it's in China's long-term interest not to have a war in the region or with the U.S. It's in our interest, too, and what we need is the kind of smart, sophisticated, nuanced leadership that can appeal to the best interests and the best spirits of all the leaders on both sides.
Let's go now to Saeed in Lorton, Virginia. Good morning to you.
Good morning, Diane. Thank you very much for allowing me to be on there. My question pertains to Afghanistan, and I think your three guests are well informed and their comments were very balanced as far as the realities on the ground are concerned in Afghanistan. As a former Afghan diplomat now living in the United States of America and working for the Voice of America, I will just suggest that unless there are the three essential steps are taken in Afghanistan, the situation is not going to resolve, and the conflict will grow in the years to come, and the Taliban will grow further and further. The first step which has to be taken is to enable the Afghan government to have a functioning national army in the real sense, and bring in the military structure that existed prior to the military coup of 1957, in Afghanistan.
All right. And
also, the economic aid should be diverted directly to the Afghan finance ministry, not to the contractors, then subcontractors. It is just a waste of money and energy.
All right.
And also, the United States of America has an obligation not to overlook the sacrifices of the ordinary Afghans for their own country. So in order to achieve the long-term strategic and security goals of the United States of America, and for that matter, that of Afghanistan, there must be some practical and realistic plans for Afghanistan.
Saeed, thank you for your call. Jonathan.
I think that the last comment that the former Afghan diplomat made is probably the most important, and that is there has to be a long-term plan. Most people will agree that there hasn't been any kind of really nuanced, realistic strategy for Iraq, for Afghanistan, because it's been kind of the foster child in terms of U.S. foreign policy. Iraq has taken all of the energy and most of the resources, most of the troops that were diverted from the effort in Afghanistan after the United States went in 01. He brings up some very important points. A lot of people will agree that the Afghan National Army is probably the biggest success story in Afghanistan today. But the fact is that, yes, the Afghan government doesn't get to spend a lot of the money that it is being given by the international community. There are some good reasons behind that. But also, you know, it had a pretty good functioning bureaucracy before the Civil War began back in the 70s. It's people are bright, they're skilled. There need to be more Afghans involved in the running and the administration of their own country. But the fact is that all of this needs to be put together in a cogent strategy that includes putting more troops in, that includes looking at better coordination, which has really been lacking between the military effort and the reconstruction effort.
And Tom Shanker, this is really what you were writing
absolutely
about.
I think clearly the gentleman who called and Secretary Gates have been having coffee together because Secretary Gates has approved this very expensive Afghan proposal to expand the Afghan National Army as the one institution in the country that best offers the prospect of stability.
But how do you make the economic aid that goes to the government, if you will, of Afghanistan really go where it needs to go?
Well, I think for far too long, I mean, there's a military phrase that if all you have is a hammer, every problem looks like a nail. And so we've applied the military hammer to Afghanistan, and it's time to bring in the full spectrum of American power, agriculture, economic, business, all of that to make, as Jonathan said, an integrated program for stability there.
But, you know, this is a country where influence has long been bought and sold, and people switch allegiances, warlords switch allegiances mm-hmm. all the time based on whoever's going to give them the most for their followers at any given moment. And one of the reasons that this point about how the economic aid is distributed is so important is that one reason the central government of Hamid Karzai has been so weak is that they haven't really had enough of that money and projects to give out themselves to sort of help win and buy that loyalty. This is the way Afghanistan's worked for years. We can't change that in the next few years. And unless he's empowered to actually, you know, win over these people directly, you're never going to have a strong central government.
Now to Cincinnati, Ohio. Good morning, Robert. Robert, are you there? I guess not. A number of our callers have asked about Ron Suskind's book and your opinion of it. It's titled The Way of the World, and some of the statements he makes in that book are pretty damning as far as the Bush administration's decision to go to war. Kevin Whitelaw?
Well, I'll have to admit I haven't had a chance to read through the full book yet, so I'm a little hesitant to speak on the allegations. But some of them do involve the you know whether or not some you know documents were forged at various times to help make a case for war, I think you know some people have you know most of us who've looked at that so far aren't really sure we can confirm any of those things. So I think this is going to take some further study.
But. And Kevin Rwanda this week issued a report accusing French officials, top French officials, and the French military of complicity in the 1994 genocide in Rwanda.
Well, this is an ongoing problem between the current regime in Rwanda and the French government. The French government was a strong supporter of the previous regime, the one that ended up committing and orchestrating the genocide. And so there have long been questions about what the French role was in the time leading up to the genocide, as well as French actions during and following on the genocide, and certainly some allegations that I think are pretty well founded, that when the French finally did intervene, they actually ended up helping to protect this regime that had perpetrated all these crimes and allowed a lot of the leaders and followers to escape. As to the actual allegations of top officials being involved in assassinations, that's going to be a lot more difficult for anyone to prove.
At 7 minutes before the hour, you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. And finally, Tom Schenker, Alexander Solzhenitsyn died near Moscow this week. He was 89. What was his legacy?
Well, not just as a Nobel Prize winner, but a man whose moral power spoke not just to Russian people, but to people around the world. I spent 5 years in Moscow as a correspondent. Those years my wife counts as 5 winters. And you cannot in any way underestimate the moral authority of this man with an Old Testament beard who documented the horrors of Stalin's labor camps in Siberia. And it's people like, you know, Solzhenitsyn and Sakharov and the others who defined the boundaries of Soviet life and the limits of the dictatorship that really set the rules and the path by which communism collapsed. And his legacy, I think, is relevant even today. We were talking earlier about the Olympics. When you look at other communist countries around the world, China, Cuba, North Korea, where are the great moral characters, the leaders, whether in the country or in exile, who are riding with such power and authority to say, here's a better way?
Of course, he wasn't too happy even once he got here to the States, Jonathan Landau.
He made a very famous speech, a commencement speech at Harvard University, in which he proceeded to denounce Western materialism, pronounced the West as being weak compared to the East getting stronger. He was a mystery. He kind of, yes, he was this incredible moral voice, but he also took the United States to task for not fighting harder in Vietnam. He has lately, before he died, seemed to be somewhat enamored of Putin, the path that Putin has taken Russia away from democracy and towards greater authoritarianism. He also seemed to have this penchant for Russian nationalism. He talked about creating a new sort of orthodox Russian empire that would fold back in Belarus and some of the other former Soviet republics, including parts of, I believe, Kazakhstan, where he claimed were majority Russian. So he, even to the end, you know, he remained this mysterious combination of different messages.
Well, you know, it's one of those reminders too that when he became famous for speaking out and writing about some of the atrocities, a lot of people latched onto him for a lot of their own reasons, mm-hmm. and I think later ended up feeling that they might have erred in going so far along with him, because it turned out he wasn't. He was indeed critical of these things, but it wasn't because mm-hmm. he thought America was great. Now, it's just a reminder that he set his own path, and that obviously coincided with the views of a lot of people for a while, but certainly not on everything.
Kevin Whitelaw of U.S. News and World Report, Jonathan Landay of McClatchy Newspapers, Tom Shanker of The New York Times. Thank you all so much.
Thank you, Diane.
Thank you.
And thanks for listening, everyone. Have a great weekend. Back with you on Monday. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Jonathan Smith, and Tanya Weinberg, with help from Susan Neighbors. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Dori Annisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives and CD sales, transcripts from Softscribe, and podcasts. Call 202-885-1200 for more information. Our email address is drshow@wamu.org. This program comes to you from American University in Washington. This is NPR, National Public Radio.